exactly, more or less. So welcome to the session.
It's your library website.
It's your fault. My name is Angie Hicks. I work here at McAllister, and it's my pleasure to introduce Matthew Reitzma from Grand Valley State University. So this is this little bio here. He believes in, as I'm sure we'll find out, user-centered design, progressive enhancement, clean code, ginger ale, which I'm assuming is Verner's, since you're from
No.
And that just the year the Cubs will go all the way. So we know he's optimistic, delusional, but optimistic. And with that, we'll hand it over to Matthew. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Well, hello everybody. Thanks for coming. Coming down. Wow,
there are a lot of people on this room.
Well, I'm not sure whether that's a good thing that a lot of people showed up for a talk called "Your Library Looks Like Stinks." And if you're looking for ammo, maybe for other people, I don't know. We'll see how that plays out. But anyway, thanks for coming along. A couple things, real quick. I created a custom hashtag. This is a mechanism. You've heard of the Twitters. I'm going to write it up here because it's the only slide that's done. If you want to tweet anything, I have a little aggregator that's grabbing everything with this hashtag, so I can see anything that any comments you're making or whatever. It would be really great if you use that. If you don't, that's fine. You can do whatever you want. But, anyway, Twitter is fun. Please tweet. You can also follow along the slides. A version from last night, probably three drafts ago, are up online at this URL. On that page, you can get slides. All the resources I'm going to talk about, as well as some others that are useful, are linked from there. And there's also a little aggregator that'll pull all everybody's tweets that have this hashtag, so you can just have the page open. You can see what all the other superstars in this room are saying. It's the magic of technology. Somebody earlier today in a session said, "The internet is awesome," and it was totally in a different context. But I remember breaking that out and thinking, "Oh, that would be a good quote by itself." So. Imagine. So one other thing, real quick. I stole this from my pal John here yesterday. There are like five other sessions going on right now, and I'm recording this on my computer. I have the slides up. I have all the things linked. If you're on the fence about something else, feel free to go to another session. You can get all this information on the site. You can play the recording. It'll all be available to you. So don't feel like you have to be here if you want to go see something else. So feel free. Now is your chance. We're all watching. Okay. And once again, just like John, some reason it didn't work. Nobody left. So thank you for that. So everybody's here. All right. In 1939, a couple of electrical engineers, Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard, started a little company in a garage. You probably all heard this story. Called Hewlett-Packard. Basically, what they wanted to do at the time was make test equipment by electrical engineers for electrical engineers. And their motto when they started this company was, build for the person at the next bench. And it was a really great way to design excellent test equipment for experts. And it worked well for them until their audience changed. And then they had to come up with a new solution. Because when you build equipment for experts, and you try to give it to people who are not experts, it doesn't work. People get frustrated, they don't like it, and they want something that's a little easier and more intuitive to use. Now, Hewlett-Packard is still around. They just recently got knocked off as number one tech company in the world by some other little upstart. I think they're also in the garage, I don't know. But they adapted. When they started moving into the consumer market, they didn't make really complicated electronics or experts. This is coming from someone who's never owned a Hewlett-Packard laptop, so I may be totally wrong. So in libraries, it's a very similar parallel to this, right? In the 70s, especially, we start pushing up our catalogs online, right? Basically, these are electronic versions of our catalog that we're using internally so that librarians, experts, can find our resources a lot faster, right? So they're expert tools designed by experts for experts, and they're working really well, really great. This keeps going through the 80s. More and more people are putting things online, and then the internet shows up, and we let the public in. This is a screenshot I took of my university's catalog advanced search page yesterday. Yes, I am the one responsible for this. That's a long story. I didn't make it. but I'm in charge of making it look better, and it hasn't happened. So we're all in this together, is what I'm trying to say. The problem is we let everybody in, right, but we didn't really change the tool. The tool is still the tool we made for experts, right? But we're letting in people who are not experts. So what is our solution then? How many people in this room are in a teaching librarian position where you go into classrooms and you try to teach people how to use tools? Okay, pretty much, what, if we had a phone poller, we'd have a more accurate, but I'd say 75% at least, right, are raising their hand. How many of those people, I should have had to keep one hand up or something, this is going to be statistically inaccurate, I'm sorry. So how many of those people also, when you're teaching, spend at least some of your time going, first you have to click here. Yeah. Okay. Now, can you imagine if you were in like a trade school and you were teaching people to build houses, and you had to teach somebody how to use a hammer? That's what we're doing. We're teaching tools and not processes, right? Teach carpentry. Don't teach the hammer. We need to teach people better. But our tools stink so bad. I mean, if a hammer looked like that, I'd need help. So this is the problem. Our interfaces are made for these experts, and the experts are not the people who are generally using them. So what happens is we end up irritating our users, right? Users get frustrated. They're trying to do different things in the library website. They can't figure out how to do it. They vent. This is, by the way, all from one-hour block in an afternoon. I just did a random search for a library website, and this is pretty much what you'll find. You know, and this one is amazing to me. This is my favorite one because it's like, oh, it's my fault, right? This person thinks it's their fault, but they can't find the link. No, you know, no. There are other issues at stake here. So it's not going well for us. Our users are not happy. Basically, all we're generating with some of these interfaces is a lot of anger. So we need to kind of rethink, regroup. And we know that, right? We got a lot of people in this room who probably came here because you thought, yes. The sad thing, this is an aside, the sad thing is I have this conversation with a lot of librarians. I never once had a librarian say to me, you know what's awesome? Library websites. and yet, library websites all stink, so what's going on, right? Like, you know, something weird is going on. So I don't know, the one librarian who's in charge of all the library websites is not in this room, but we need to find it. So one of the first things you have to do, I mean, if you want to try to fix this issue, right, we have to think, well, why do we even have websites, right? What's the point? How many of you have been at your university long enough to where you remember when your library got a website? Okay, did you guys ever sit down and go, why are we going to do this? Do we really need a website? Anybody?
I don't remember.
Yeah. I would guess you probably didn't, right? Because what happens is, everybody's doing it. The cool kids are doing it, right? Everybody, you gotta have a website now. You buy one of those energy drinks. It has a website. Why does an energy drink need a website? I don't know. You know, learn more about your. I don't want to learn more. This is the first place we have to start, though. Why do we even have this website to begin with? Right. So in general, we have really noble aspirations for why we have these websites, right? We want to share our resources. We have a lot of resources, and we want to make sure everybody knows about them, and we're going to put them all out there, right? We're going to line them up, and it's a great goal. But the problem is when you actually put this into practice, apologies to anybody who works here, it gets a little crazy, right? There are 58 links on this page. This is the home page. My favorite part of this page, though, is that the navigation dropdown lets you duplicate all the links on the home page. So you can have even more. It's incredible. It's really great. So listen. So what I love about this page, too, is you can imagine that if you were to say, let's build a library website based exactly on how our library is laid out, this is what you You have rows and rows of bookshelves with all our resources on them, out for everybody to find. oh, and then we better have a little desk where somebody can go and, you know, have some computers with the OPAC on them where they can search things, or a card catalog if we're in the olden days. Somewhere we're going to have a reference desk where people need to come and ask some questions, right? If this were the public library, oh, that's what we have over here. Let's put in a little bulletin board where we can put news and events, and maybe a new book table, right? These are all like, probably all of you are going like, oh, that's our website. This is built like an old library, right? So how many of you are looking at old libraries and going like, oh, we need to put in a cafe and have beanbags and other things, right? You know, you want to change the space because the way people use the space is different. We're building websites exactly the way we built them in the 90s, and actually exactly the way we built library building for the last 100 years. So stop. That's it. That's the whole talk. So the thing that we have to understand when we're thinking about why we have a website is that libraries in general add friction to all of our users' products. It doesn't matter what your user is doing. Your user did not come to the library to come to the library, right? The user is not using your website to use your website. The user is using your website because they have a paper due. You are a roadblock in their way, right? They want to write a paper. So when we talk all the time about, we need to teach people how to do good research, well, for most undergraduates especially, if you work with undergraduates, and a lot of people have come to public libraries. Again, I'm going to just feign ignorance. I'm making generalizations. I have never worked at a public library. But, you know, in a lot of the undergraduate situations and more general public audiences, people don't think about research as a different step than writing a paper or gathering the information they need to make a decision or whatever, right? It's all part of the same thing to them. So when we sort of layer on all these services and different things and we're trying to, you know, make sure they know about every possible thing we ever have available, like, no, you're writing a paper on, you know, chemistry and baseball, and oh, we could do that in Second Life, you know, whatever. That stuff gets in the way of what they're trying to do. They're basically just trying to, like, I would just want to write this paper and this, you know, all these, oh, it's just overwhelming. Quick aside. Has anyone ever used Second Life as a librarian? Okay, I'm not going to change, but I watched one of my former colleagues at another place use it once. He was trying to tell me how great it was. This was like in 2007. And this just, the metaphor of this reminds me of what it's like for most people to use a library website. So, you know, we go to log into the Second Life, and I'm standing there in First Life. And he flies to Information Island, which was weird. And we land, and we immediately get mobbed by all these people. You know, these avatars with, like, buns and glasses. And they all say, can we help you? We're like, no, I'm also a librarian. And the thing was, you could barely get a word in, because these people were like, I want to help you. And it was great. All these people on a little island in the middle of a computer want to help you find stuff. But, you know, you really just want to kind of get to where you're going, but there's all these people kind of like throwing things. And there's got to be a way, right, to show people these types of resources. The thing is, this is how most people expect search to work for them. This is just talking about the search aspect, right? This itself is a little cumbersome still, but this is what people have come to expect from places like Google. You do a search, you get a result screen, and you get immediately to the result. You click whatever that thing is, and boom, there's your thing. This is how libraries generally work. This is a best case scenario. So now at my institution, Grand Valley State, we have Summon, which is a discovery layer. It uses a central index, and they're just starting to direct link articles. So we're getting closer to this. So there's a tiny portion of like zoology searches that will work magically. We don't have a zoology program. But basically what happens is you do a search and you get a result screen and you're feeling great, and then in many cases you get our link resolver, right, which says here's all the places you can see that, and everybody's like, where is the thing? And if you're super lucky, that open URL will work and it'll actually get you to a result, and that's just like one step more than Google, right? And the percentage of times this happens is like, there's so many zeros after the point before you get to one. It's just, it never works. A lot of times you end up, oh, we get to a journal page. Oh, okay, I was looking for, now I'm in a journal, and I guess I have to find the issue, and then I have to scroll through 400 different articles on 20 pages to find the one. What was that article? I don't even know, because I just did a search. I had to go back. And what was the article title? And I had to find it. And then if I'm lucky, somewhere, I'm falling asleep. And I don't have my, you know, I just get one, right? So this is a problem, right? This is a lot of friction we're adding into this research process for people. So our goal with our, like, why we have a library website is to share our resources. That's great. But we also need to reduce the amount of friction involved in that research, right? Stop getting in the way of people who are getting to their thing. And the main reason for that, I mean, there are a lot of reasons. We should be doing it. It's a nice thing to do. But mostly, our competition is really good at that. This is your competition, right? They're very good at removing all those barriers for search, including this crazy little thing which has been freaking me out lately. Anybody see this little microphone that shows up in the input now? I'm afraid that I'm going to click it down and Google's going to start going, Dave. I'm scared, Dave. So good. So we know now, right, this is very fast. You just figured out what your website's for. That's great. So we're going to move on. You've got a website, you want to share your resources, you want to reduce friction, you want to help your patrons. Well, who are your patrons, right? You got to figure this out. Now, the lucky thing is that it's not librarians. We know that. But you'd never know that by looking at most library websites, right? And again, I'm sorry. I really am. But it's not for us. And that's hard sometimes to swallow, because it's been for us for a long time, and it started out for us, right? We put this stuff online to make our lives easier internally, and when we opened it up to the public, I think we forgot that part of it, right? We just thought everybody can do it. And so we need to work on trying to figure out who our actual users are. So we have to find out. So how do you do that, right? Well, as libraries, we have sort of a dream scenario, especially if you are an academic library. Okay, because academic libraries actually have a whole office on your campus whose job it is to keep a list of all the people who are supposed to be using your library, and they have all kinds of information about them. So it's a great resource to tap, right? Every person that's enrolled at your institution, every person that works there, and every person who teaches there is your target audience. That's easy. You could just like tune out for the next 5 minutes because you're done. That's great. Very easy to figure out who your audience is. Now, some academic libraries might say, well, we have people coming in from the outside, and blah, blah, blah. You know, that's true, right? We're serving a larger public than all of that. But your main mission and who you're supposed to be serving, who you're essentially set up to serve, primarily are the people of your universities. Public libraries, it's a little different. You could make the argument that you're there to serve all the taxpayers. I mean, that's one way to look at it, right? But you're there to serve all the patrons of your library, whatever that means, whether they're using your materials, whether they're using your space, whatever. Those are the people you're there to serve. Basically, you're there to serve 100% of your patrons. Okay. Now, your website is for 100% of your patrons. And I would argue, with very little exception, that 100% of your patrons use your website. So I know there's somebody in here is going, wait a minute, not all of our patrons own computers, right? But is your library catalog on your website? Okay. Are all your resources on your website? Do you have computers in your library that connect to your website, right? Those people are using your website to get to those resources, whether they're going outside the library or not, even in the library. Everybody gets to your stuff through the website. So I don't know if anybody was in Rudy's little talk a couple of sessions ago where she talked about just how few people, especially in academic libraries, actually come through the front door compared to how many people use the online resources. So 100% of your patrons come through your website, right? Another quick aside, this is one area where we have a lot to improve, right? We have, in some sense, bad library websites because we haven't caught up yet in some ways with the HR culture, or our HR hasn't caught up with the culture of the library changing, right? If you look at your library staff directory, and you look at how many people are tasked to handle public-facing services, and then you look at how many people are tasked to handle the website, right? And then you now take that data and go to the session on data visualization from earlier, and overlay it with data on your web usage stats, and overlay that with your gate counts. And you're going to see a huge disparity. You're spending an insane amount of time and resources on a small percentage of your patrons that are coming through the door, right? Compared to the website. So, I mean, this is not a quick fix, right? This is a big systemic issue that is eventually probably will hopefully work itself out, right? We have to make that shift. We've already been making that shift into other models, but it's such a slow movement. Anyway, total aside and another type of mind. So now we know why we have a website, we know who our website's for. You all did that, right? You're all done, you got it written down. There's a quiz afterwards. So. We need to know, what do our users actually need, right? Well, generally how we do this is we say, I know what the user needs, right? I interact with them every day. I know what their problems are. You know, your users don't actually even know what their problems are. That's the amazing thing, right? If anybody here ever actually conducted usability tests where you sat down with users and watched them use your website? Okay. Have you ever, like, if you ask them questions about how they think they use the website, and you watch them use it, do they ever correlate? Or what percent? Sometimes, but not often, right? I mean, the idea of how you do things is so different from the way you actually do it. And you can experiment with this on yourself, right? You're all information professionals. You're all like, I know how to use a website really well. I know how to do great searching. Next time you go to Google and you make a search, immediately when you're done, remember this comment. Don't do it beforehand because you'll gain the system. And think about, how did I just do that search? You did not do that search, probably, the way you were taught to search in library school. Right? But you go around, you have to search better. I learned, let me teach you how to use advanced search. Nobody ever uses those in the wild, right? We use them when we're thinking about it, and we think like, oh, I really got to do this crazy complicated search, and so I'm going to do it. And that's great. That's a great tool. But most of the time, people don't do this, even us. But we forget about that, right? Our brains are just like wired to just ignore the fact that we just, you know, are not paying attention to what we learned that we paid $30,000 to learn, you know? So keep this in mind. Your users don't even know what they want, right? You need to figure that out. And that's hard. It's really, really hard to figure that out. But basically the idea is you want to leave mind reading to the professionals, okay? We want to really connect with the users and actually figure out what's going on. So Whitney Hess, who's a user experience design consultant, who speaks a lot of places, writes a great blog, I highly recommend, talks a lot about, she was responding to this idea from an article a couple weeks ago in Fast Company, I think. Who knows? I can't keep those magazines straight. Slow Company, it was one of those. And the guy was talking about basically building a user experience culture in your corporate environment. And he said, you know, he made this whole analogy in this article about how Don Draper from Mad Men. How many Mad Men fans do we have here? Okay. Everybody see the episode where he demos the Kodak slide carousel, you know, it's this great, I mean, it's a wonderful moment in this show where he's talking about nostalgia and he's showing family slides and talking about the importance of the idea of nostalgia and family and memories and all this stuff around this product and building up this emotional response, and it's wonderful, right? And that's what user experience design is supposed to be about, is getting people to connect with all this stuff. The problem is Don Draper thought that up in his office with a bottle of scotch, right? He didn't go and talk to any users about this. That's the difference. So she says, look, a lot of times people think user experience design is about expert intuition, but it's not. It's about expert listening, right? It's about finding out what your users need, whether it's what they're saying directly, because again, they might not know what they need, but watching them to determine what they really are trying to do and what they really need. So you can do this a couple ways. Actually, you need to do it all these ways. You don't want to just pick and choose, but these are the three core ways you want to kind of get into this. So there's user research. You need to talk to your user. Some of the best ways to do this are to interview your users, sit down with them. Sit down with them while they're doing work, right? If you're a reference librarian and you do a lot of help in your computer labs or different things like that, when people ask you questions or, you know, you're doing a reference interview, these are great opportunities to actually do guerrilla user interviews, right? You're seeing how people, if you're letting them work on the website and do the search, you're seeing how they're trying to actually do the search themselves, and you can spot these problems. The problem is that, though, these interviews are really, really time sensitive, right? So doing this with a lot of users takes a lot of time, and there's some shortcuts to it. You can do a lot of interviews, you can build personas. Anybody heard of personas? Essentially where you interview a bunch of people and you sort of create a melange of that all these different people's attributes that represent particular targeted divisions in your audience. So you might have, you know, undergraduate, humanities majors, you know, might be represented by a persona, and that you really flesh that out and to be almost like a real person. So you have a document that you can constantly refer to say, well, if we make this choice, how's that going to affect the humanities students? How's that going to affect the social science students? All these types of things. There's a lot of resources online, and I'll add some of them to the website, where you can learn how to build personas. But I don't want to talk too much about that. I want to talk about the quickest, cheapest, easiest way to do it that will give you the best payout, which is complete every feedback loop. So you saw on Twitter earlier, I posted a lot of screenshots of people who are complaining about library websites. There's a lot of places people like to complain about library websites. Unfortunately, not often to the library or the person responsible for the website. And some of that is because they're not that accessible, right? My library department, Technology and Information Systems, has a culture that if a patron ever gets to us, something's wrong. That's kind of the attitude they have, which I think is nuts. So when I got there, it was very difficult to even figure out who would possibly be in charge of the website, and if you had a problem, how to get in touch with them. So make it really, really easy for your users to get in touch with you with anything from, you know, suggestions, bugs in the system, problems they're encountering, any roadblocks, any of that kind of stuff, right? This is a no-brainer, super passive way you can just have a link somewhere that gets people, not on the homepage, by the way, with the 50 other ones. Don't put it there. But make it easy for people to find this link on every single page so they can report something, get in touch with somebody, you know, whether it's your Ask a Librarian, whether it's a contact form, whatever it is, make sure people can get in touch with you about any kind of issue. And the most important thing is you got to complete that feedback loop. So track every single one of those responses and write back to everybody. Right? We have 24,000 people at my university. I write back to every single person who contacts me. I probably write a half a dozen emails a week, right? Or tweets or whatever. It's not a huge overhead. But the thing is, you're basically getting people on your team by making them feel like they're being heard. Even if you say, thank you for your suggestion, but we're not going to put dancing hamsters on the homepage. You know, whatever it is that you're actually, you know, refining them to, make sure you always follow that through. One of the great things is if you get a lot of feature requests, right, or which you're probably going to get more from, if public libraries will get this from sort of power users, or academic libraries will get these from teaching faculty almost always, and it'll always be like, can you put this link to, you know, zoology in the 19th century database on the homepage, please? So I don't, you know, they want the like most obscure thing that no one ever uses, so it's easy for them to find. Track all that stuff, right? Keep a spreadsheet, even if you have to. A really simple spreadsheet where you can track every feature request you get and the email address of everybody who asked for it. So if you get a lot of people asking for the same thing, and you realize, look, this is bubbling up, right? We really need to think about implementing this. This is a problem a lot of people are facing. You can email those people when you implement it and say, hey, we did it. Thanks for letting us know. It is insane how much goodwill you'll get for doing that. It's so simple and so easy, and if you just do that, just connect with them and make all those opportunities to be a sort of like continuous feedback loop, it'll be a great payoff for you guys. The second thing is usability test. So I'm going to ask this one more time. I know I already said it. How many people have ever done a usability test on your website? Okay, so a lot of people have done them. Okay. How many people do usability tests more than once a year? Oh, okay. So here's the thing about usability tests. If you do one usability test every 3 to 5 years or whenever you do a redesign, it tells you nothing, absolutely nothing. It's not, don't even do it. It's actually kind of a waste of time. Because a usability test only works when it's rolled into a system of constant iterative update. So you need to be doing these frequently. And they don't have to be super, super time consuming. You don't need a lab, you don't need a two-way mirror, you don't need anything fancy. We do usability testing at Grand Valley every month. at least once a month. We do it, our entire technology for it is two decommissioned 2007 Mac laptops, a $25 USB microphone, iChat, which is built into all the Macs. You can just Skype with your PCs. And Camtasia, which we happen to have for another thing. That was the only thing that actually cost money, so to speak. And what we do is we, people come into my office, students, we book three students every month, come in for half-hour sessions. We have another room on campus that has one of the laptops connected via screen sharing through either iChat or Skype. We invite every single person in the library. Everybody who works in the library is invited to the observation room. That's 60 people. Anyone can come. We don't care what position you are. We try to get everybody in the room because you're going to get better, a better sense of, that's 2 weeks ago. I'll get to that second. Why you want everybody in the room. We do this way. It's super cheap. It's super easy. It takes 2.5 hours of actual committed time from whoever can be there. And they can come and go. We let people drop in for a couple sessions, write down some notes, and leave them for us, and we'll evaluate that. And it takes me a few, not sort of on autopilot, but it still does take me probably a good half day to put together scheduling all the students and doing everything else. But I can tell you that nothing has improved our website more than having this regular testing, where we're actually putting the site through the paces, and everybody's kind of hammering. At the end of every test, I do three half-hour sessions of an hour and a half, and then we book an hour in the conference room for everybody who is at the session to debrief. So I come upstairs, everybody closes their computers, whatever, we just get the whiteboard out, and I say, what did you see? And we just hammer out all the problems we saw. This is from a test a couple weeks ago. Whether I can actually, decode these for you. But these are all problems in our catalog, right? So we found that the star things are the things that we said, these are really big problems that we need to address right now. And we're going to get these done before the next test, and we're going to retest. And we're going to see if we fix those problems. So one interesting thing is, when I showed up, we had the world's worst link resolver. Well, actually, anybody who has 360 link has the world's worst link resolver. But we have 360 link, and it was exactly out of the box. The only thing we had added was our banner at the top, right? So if you've seen 360 link in its default state, it looks like one of those chickens that doesn't have any feathers, So we started working on that because in an environment where you have a tool like Summon that's linking people directly to articles and using that link resolver, it is the number two traffic page on our site, right behind the homepage, where people are doing search. And it is the number one point of failure for every single search we have. And most of the reasons that it fails are not technical. It's not because open URLs are bad. Sure, that happens a lot. But the number one reason is people can't figure out where to go, right? So we hammered and hammered and hammered on this, and we've been testing it monthly every month. And maybe it's a fluke, but the last usability test, not a single person got anything wrong in the link resolver. Do you know how amazing of a feeling that was? If we hadn't done that test every single month, maybe next month everybody will, start throwing chairs at me or something when I have them use it. But, it's an amazing feeling to see that progression and make those iterative changes month after month after month and finally see, look, people are actually getting through. Our resource numbers are up, right? So our analytics are actually sort of backing this up, saying people are getting through more things. It's really exciting to be able to do this. And it's pretty low overhead. Which brings you to web analytics. So first, you want to talk to your users, right? Figure out what is it they think they need, what do they really need. We're going to test some of those prototypes that we're building. And then we're going to actually look and sort of look at the back end and see what are they really doing, right? This is going to help inform that what do they really need as opposed to what do they think they need. Got a lot of tools for this. I'm sure you guys are familiar with Google Analytics. It's a pretty program. It'll give you a lot of great information. Spring break started. So definitely use Google Analytics. If you want to get a little bit more fancy, one of the things we do, this is our current homepage in its ever-progressing state of getting better. And one of the ways that one of the tools that's really helped me is a tool called Reinvigorate, which is another analytics program. And I'll tell you why. If you sit in a room, how many people were at the data visualization talk? Are the data visualization people here? I don't see you. Oh, yes. So sometimes showing people a picture will get a lot more across than showing them a bunch of numbers. So you can show them what, how many times this link was clicked, and you know, people probably don't care. But if you say, you know, nobody really uses anything except for the search box, and you show them a heat map, that's really useful, right? So when I came in, we had 28 links in the database, and I whittled it down in our first design to 12. That was as far, that's as much political capital as I had to spend. But now I think I have a little bit more. Now the other interesting thing is, in every usability test, I follow up every time a user clicks on that database link right below the enormous search box to do a search for an article. I say, have you ever had library instruction? Every person that clicks that database link says yes. Right? Nobody who just searches in the box says yes. So what I realized was we're teaching people to use tools, right? Even though we had some in our tools in 2009, we're still telling people to go to databases, right? And some of that, you know, it depends on what you're doing, right? Some is not always the best tool, right? But we're still making people choose the appropriate tool before they search, and that's crazy. So stuff like this, I mean, this is wrapped in a, if anybody knows HTML, this is in a div, which has a class on it called appeasement, which just makes me laugh when I write it, because I put things in there in appeasement classes that don't need to really be on the website, but I can't be in that tool for that. So these are things I can't touch. So sometimes you do that. My note here, by the way, says, a picture can kill 1,000 links. So reinvigorate.net is a free trial. I think we pay $100 a year for this tool, which is not a huge investment. Because I will tell you that the previous web services librarian fought and fought and fought with regular data. I installed this, got 2 months worth of data, walked into a room, took one picture, and everybody was on board immediately. So it was worth $100. Now, a caveat. You can't just do web analytics, right? Your data doesn't mean anything unless you really know what your users are trying to do. So you gotta always balance all these things. Also, I highly recommend following UX Yoda. So you know why you have a website. You know who the website's for, and you now have a pretty good idea of what the user needs, right? So now, great. What do we do now, right? We know what they need. So you want to do that, and you only want to do that. Don't do anything else. Just do that. That's what you're there for. We're there to help these users do what they need to do. However, as you probably all know, hence why you're here, this is going to get really ugly. People have very strong opinions about websites, especially when they're in an organization where they had a say in the past, for instance, as to what happens, or maybe their former job, it was their job to make the website. This is going to be a mess. Doing work on the website is 90% political. All right. So there's a lot of ways that we have to sort of be careful about how we go about stuff. I've had numerous conversations with a lot of you over the last couple days about, we would love to do this, but right, IT won't let us. The administration won't let us. So and so won't let us. Right? A lot of roadblocks. And these are all political roadblocks, not technical roadblocks. So how do you get through some of these? Now, I'm going to be perfectly honest here and say, compared to some of the stories I've heard from you, I work in Shangri-La. So, it helps. I mean, some tips. I've worked at places before I had my MLS. I did exactly the same job I'm doing now. Nobody would listen to me because I didn't have an MLS. Despite the fact that technically an MLS doesn't tell you anything about how to make a website. Nobody would listen to me. It's just built into the culture, right? Other issues, at my library we happen to have faculty status. I happen to be the first person on the technology side who is a faculty member. That helped me when I came in because all the research and instruction librarians, who I like to call my roadblocks, not all of them, but a few, they all had faculty status. And so being on the same level as them in the organization helped with this, right? Because there's a lot of things that maybe are out of your control and you're just going to have to get creative with, right? Or wait for retirement. So the first thing to remember is that bad library websites are actually a symptom of a library culture that only gives lip service to user needs, right? So we often say, yes, we want to help the user. and I know how to help the user, right? That's not actually what the user wants. They don't want you to tell them what you think they need. They want to actually have what they need. So part of this is a cultural change thing. We need to really start thinking about how do we change that library culture to really, really focus on actually what users need and not what we think users need. There's a little bit longer article, but it's also linked to the thing down at the bottom if you're interested in that. So how do you fix a culture? The best example I've ever seen is from 1989's Roadhouse. Anybody see this movie? You guys know this movie? Okay. So Patrick Swayze, here's the premise. Patrick Swayze is the best bouncer in the business, and he's hired to clean up a dirty bar, right? The organizational culture of the bar is bad, and they bring Patrick Swayze in. There's a lot of reasons I like this movie. There's explosions. There's a certain parallel. I watched this movie actually for the first time after I started this position, and Patrick Swayze in this movie is a former philosophy major who is now a bouncer, and I'm a former philosophy major who's also but I thought to myself, perfect, right? So he goes in and he makes some organizational changes that are not about changing technology and changing. The doors are giving people muscle shirts or whatever, right? He goes in and he actually changes the way people behave to other people, right? This is his whole idea. And it works, right? If you've seen the movie, for the most part, towards the end, he gets a little crazy and he tears out somebody's throat and there's explosions, but we don't have to do that. We should stop before the throat gets torn out. I highly recommend this movie, by the way. It's the most ridiculous movie of all. So anyway, he has a couple of tips, though, that I want to share with you.
All you have to do is follow three simple rules. One, never underestimate your opponent. Expect the unexpected. Two, take it outside. Never start anything inside the bar unless it's absolutely necessary. And three, be nice.
That's it, right? I mean, we could sort of modify the first two. Probably work pretty well in libraries. I'll be giving a whole talk on this in November at the Michigan Library Association. If you just on this clip, so if you want to learn more. we need to be nice, right? So often this is an adversarial thing, and we get into it. You're doing this a dumb way, So we have to think about better ways to approach these types of issues. And being nice is actually super effective. I've actually found out it's crazy and simple, but if you're just nice and you just say, yeah, we could do it that way, or that's one little solution, Just being nice to people and genuinely actually getting to know some of those roadblocks. Many of them are nice in advance, so we get along great. And it's been wonderful to find those bridges, right? In addition to being nice, you got to do other things like be patient. I mentioned earlier that we had many links on our homepage, and we're down to 12. They will all go away soon, but I couldn't get them all done at the first pass, right? And I thought to myself, I'm going to be here for a while. I'll wait. It's fine. Once we can show people that fewer links actually does work, you'll get permission to do more. But sometimes you just have to be patient. You just have to wait, and you have to kind of pick your battles, right? Sometimes it's going to take a while to get through. Another great tip is to understand the culture you're in. This is a huge one. So when I came to Grand Valley, everybody had an opinion about everything, which is not unusual. But somehow, those people were able to actually exert their non-existent power with those opinions, and I thought, that's crazy. They could hold everything up. At meetings, if one person had an objection to something, we would sit there for hours. And I just thought, this is crazy, right? I came to Grand Valley, I was a teaching faculty there, but I was also running my own web design company, working by myself, which I never held myself up in any meeting. So it was very hard for me to figure this out, what is going on? So I had a conversation with somebody, and this was just within the last month or two, who's been there a while, and he said, before we got the dean we have now, which was 7 years ago, the previous dean had Thursday afternoon meetings. This was a meeting for all the faculty and all the administrative professionals. And they would all sit in a room all afternoon on Thursday. Does this sound awesome? Aren't you guys excited about this? And every decision about the library would get made in that room with everybody present. And the new dean came in and said, that's crazy. We're not doing that. But you know what? Like, 7 years it's hard to break a habit like that. So understanding that culture let me be a little bit more irrationally angry about some of those issues and say, well, you know what? They're really used to having a say in all these types of things. So I can preemptively go to them and say, hey, here's what we're thinking about doing. Can we sit down and, you know, let me buy you a cup of coffee. We'll kind of talk these issues out. These people now are not my roadblocks anymore, right? Because I try to understand where they're coming from. I'm nice to them, right? It's just really easy. It's amazing how little this sort of simple stuff is. The other thing is get everybody to participate. I mentioned this in the usability test. We invite everybody from student employees who work at the front desk to the dean to be in that room. We, on average, every month, we have between 16 and 20 people in the observation room watching the usability test. It's not always the same people, so the people rotate in and out as they're available. What's great about this is twofold. Number one, everybody gets a sense that they're being asked to contribute, right? And they are being asked to contribute, but not in a way where we have a Thursday afternoon meeting where one person can hold everybody else up, right? We're all being asked to contribute, and we all kind of talk through the issues in a very focused way. It's still pretty clear that I would come in at the end and I moderate the session and say, here are the things that are going to get done. Here's the technical limitations we have, right? So there's still somebody who sort of, I have to kind of come in and guide some of that discussion. We get everybody in that room. The other thing is, student workers at the front desk have a very different sense of what people are doing when they watch somebody use a website than the dean does, right? And then your instruction librarians and sciences are going to have a very different sense of what people are doing sometimes than instruction librarians in the humanities. So getting all these different people, you're going to get a variety of different inputs. And you might actually learn something about why somebody might be doing something. Oftentimes, the person who ran the instruction session that told the person to do whatever weird thing they did on the website is in the room, and I can say, why, you know, why do you have them do it that way? Oh, well, because it doesn't work this other way. Well, you know, we didn't know that, but we have that person in the room, and we can all be together and sort of work on a single project. This only works when you are very focused on a single thing, right? We're doing a usability test. Here are the ground rules. I have an article linked in the resources. There's two, one called Why We Do Usability Testing that explains the why we do it, and hence the title. And then another called How We Do It. And it walks you through step by step exactly how we do it. You can learn it all from Steve Krug's excellent book, Rocket Surgery Made Easy. But we modified it a little bit. We also share all of our IRB documentation if you have to pass that through your university to do testing, as well as our consent forms. All our documentation is up there so you can grab it and modify it as you need it. So get everyone involved in that. Don't redesign your website. This is another great one to avoid political battles. Just test and iterate, right? If you do a monthly usability test and you keep making changes, you'll make changes eventually that will be a redesign. This is under the radar redesign, right? And one of the reasons, I was talking to Sean, I can't remember his last name, from University of Minnesota.
Shane Ryan,
what was his name? We were talking earlier today at breakfast, and he mentioned Parkinson's Law of Triviality, which I think applies to this. So the law essentially says the more mundane the issue, the more time will be spent arguing about it. Right? So we give an example of in a meeting with a bunch of people, they're talking about, you know, a nuclear reactor facility, and it's architects. They don't know anything about a nuclear reactor facility, so that actually that humongous decision was made within 10 minutes. But then the next item on the agenda was about a bicycle shed, which everybody understood perfectly, and it took the entire time, and they argued about colors and all, you know, crazy stuff. So if you bring up a redesign, you've got all this stuff, you know, and you know, ultimately most of that stuff is totally irrelevant to what people are going to do. They're going to focus on things like tab colors, and you're going to go down a rabbit hole that you're never going to get out of. So don't do it. Little tiny things, you know. So here is... this is not quite when I got here. This was after I had done some link removing without anybody noticing. That's another good trick, by the way. Just change it and see if anybody notices. The answer, by the way, is nobody. So this is the website that I inherited with some fewer links. And then we started doing our monthly usability tests, and we started changing things a little bit. And we kept getting feedback on different things, and again, we're mostly trying to focus people on that search box. And we kept changing, and we kept changing, until eventually, after 5 months, we had a redesign. But we didn't redesign. We just iteratively changed the website. Now, we actually, it technically felt like a redesign, because all these other ones were actually on the staging servers, they weren't live. So this is pretty dramatic. But what happened was I was able to redesign the website in 5 months without anybody knowing I redesigned the website. You know, that's for the win. That's what that is. Another good strategy, I'm going to really speed up here. Strategic compromise. Patrick Swayze in Roadhouse says, nobody wins in a fight. It's a great line. But you're not always going to win, right? So don't always fight about something. Just think about what would be the most strategic way I could compromise for this particular issue. Ask forgiveness. Again, just do it, right? People will notice. When I actually moved the entire website to the new template, the new design, I unlinked 80% of our content. So I just cut the size of the website by 80%. The pages still exist, right? They still live on the internet, but you can't get to them unless you know the URL. One of the first things I said was, the site is too big, we need to cut things. People freaked out! You can't steal my sacred cow! Okay.
But you didn't do a redesign.
We didn't do a redesign. So we moved it over to the new template, I just took away all those links. The redesign went live in June last year, so this June I will check, but as of now, I can tell you how many people have visited any of those 80% of those pages based on web analytics. Also, how many people have noticed or mentioned to me that those pages are gone. So I haven't actually had to ask for forgiveness, but just... The last thing and the hardest is eternal vigilance, right? You've got to make sure that people aren't sneaking those crazy links back on the web. Some of this involves control of the page, right? If you have a lot of people who have control over it, it's going to be harder. We had a lot of people maintaining the content here at Mailing. The first thing I did when I came in was made strategic alliances with people, and I now successfully had a coup where I control every piece of content on the entire website except for LibGuides, which I'm working on. Nobody else, only my team, can actually get and edit the content, right? We don't have that much. We got rid of so much content, we don't need to farm it out to a lot of other people to maintain it, right? But eternal vigilance. One thing that just came up was my dean asked me, we just won, Grand Valley just won the ACRL award for, I almost said award for ignorance, I don't know. Before I can flip, the award for excellence. So, same thing. I had some little ads on the website, and then I had to take it down because we had another ad. And somebody, I got an email from her suddenly that said, can you please put a banner ad on the website for the next year that says, winner of the, ACRL worker. And I said, I haven't had to do this yet, but no. For the team. But I didn't know how to go about it, so I went to her assistant to email me, and I said, what's the story here? And she said, I was just at an event, and I talked to somebody, and they said, oh, that's really cool, I've heard about the award, and they went to our website, and there wasn't a link. And I was like, there was a link yesterday. And she said, oh, I didn't know that. Well, if it's that important, then you didn't know that it was up for 3 weeks. Maybe it wasn't that important. Anyway, we ended up working it out. I said, look, that's not the way the website works. We don't put banner ads on it. But here's what we can do. And it ended up working out great. But it's a little scary. I had to say no to the dean, which I was somewhat scared about. I'm still here. I think I still have a job. So 10% of this is technical. This is the easy part, right? Be consistent. This goes for a lot of things. Don't change your navigation on every page, especially if a lot of libraries still do a different navigation on the home page than they do on the rest of the site. We do it, I'm guilty. So you can throw stones at me first. But be consistent. If you need help with being consistent on the rest of the pages, with the visual look and feel of the site, build a user interface pattern library. This is our pattern library that Grand Valley uses. Basically, this is the whole shot of it. It goes everything from our grid layout to our typography to how to make different types of navigation lists, to tables, to alert boxes, everything. Everything is in there. And it also has little handy things you can click, and it will show you how to write the code for it. This is available also on GitHub. It's linked because you want to get the source and modify it for yourself. It's based on, actually on MailChimp's user interface library, which is also linked. Write concisely and clearly. This is really hard for librarians. It's really hard for me. We need to do it because good interface design is actually mostly just writing clearly. Right? You don't have to write a lot of help if it's just easy to use. I'm going to skip some of this stuff. Pick blah, 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 blah. Here's an ugly site. It has 48 links. Here's some easy cuts. Cut your mission statements. If your library, if you can't tell what the mission of the library is from how you're providing your service, you're doing it wrong. You shouldn't have to tell people. The whole website should be your mission statement. Offer help only when needed. This is a crazy one people don't like. People don't use help sections on websites. They really don't. They want help when they're having the problem. Here's one way we did this. Here's our link resolver after we hacked it a lot. You can download the source for this too, and it'll do it for you. We knew that if people clicked the find full text online link more than once, they probably had broken links. So after two clicks, this pops out. If you come back to this page, it will just try to push you directly to document delivery. That's really what we wanted to do with people. We didn't want to try to explain why the link might not work. Just get them there. We also write to a database the open URL for this page so that our electronic resource management team knows that this page may have broken links. It allows them to do some preemptive other stuff. Kill your frequently asked questions. They're never frequent. They're never asked. They're actually just questions we thought of in a meeting. So, truth in advertising. What you need to do is you need to answer the questions in the copy, right? So here's a page that I was given recently and said, we need a page just like this to advertise our peer consultant form. And I said no. But we built this page for them, right? This has all the information that page had on it, but it's readable and easily digestible and doesn't use the FAQ format. Make it simple. Your policies are too complicated. This is a shock, right? This is a little harder one, so not really a quick cut, but if your policies were easier, you could get rid of them. This is a matrix I wrote out of our borrowing policies, and what I love about this slide is this is like an archaeological dig where you can see like the record of all these unrelated meetings like layering up on top of each other, like, you know, shale or something. So we have to have a super complicated policy page because our policies are complicated. If you have recalls in your library, Why limit renewals on certain items? Why change the borrowing period? Let people recall it. I worked at a previous library and I went to grad school at a place that you just recall it. Everything was the same amount of time. You know how easy it is to train new people on your policies when your policies are everybody gets to borrow the same amount of time, the same number of renewals, and you can just recall it? That's it. That's your training, right? And your website becomes easier. The other thing to cut, administrative ganglia of all sorts. Nobody's looking at this except for other libraries and librarians. So if you have a maintenance issue and you can't keep up with your website, hack this stuff off. If you've got long, convoluted pages about your departments and your department structure and what people are on committees, that's great stuff for your intranet, right? So the goal is take all the confusing stuff and move it to your intranet so only we have to deal with it. So anyway, if you do all this stuff, magic. So anyway, you can learn more here. Thank you. I sadly talked way too much. Too many asides. And Patrick Swayze. But I'll hang out here as long as you want. I'll be at the reception if you want to ask questions. Thank you guys.